We're back. Welcome to No Direction Beyond, the Starfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm your host, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param, and I'm joined by...
I'm James. I write Code Switch.
Excellent. Well, we've been at this for going on half a year now, and finally, besides digging our teeth into home games and Starfinder Society, James, you've embarked on a very special journey.
Yes, the journey to find Dead Sons, or to complete it. The adventure path Dead Sons, that's what I mean.
Right. I mean, our ability to actually explore the stars is limited to how much of a billionaire we happen to be at the moment. And I am really not batting very well on that score lately.
No, I'm hoping to get shoved in the Tesla trunk and shot off with the next SpaceX launch, but we'll see.
So with the Dead Sons AP kicking off, and I suspect that many of our listeners might already be very familiar with the Dead Sons AP, if for no other reason than it seems to be the only thing actual players podcasts are doing right now for Starfinder. gosh, there's so many of you all, and some of you are very good. But I really wish there was some variety out there. But currently, your choice is Starfinder Society or Dead Sons.
It'll come with time. There's a bunch of third-party modules if you'd like to try them out.
Excellent.
Some of them are pretty good.
But we're not talking about third-party modules today.
No, I don't have time to run any more games. Param, what about you?
I have very recently dialed back my commitment on running games, actually. Running three a week seemed to be a little much.
You're running three? Jeez, man. Take a break. Hit the showers.
That's what I did. I mean, I threw down my dice and immediately walked into a shower. turning it on or taking my shirt off might have been beneficial, but... No. This is a bit of a tangent, but I'm actually stepping away from being a venture officer in order to more dedicate myself to my other commitments.
You have a lot of commitments.
Oh, and so many more coming. So many more coming. All right, so Dead Sons AP. Why? Why'd you decide to jump right into the AP?
Well, let me just also preface this by saying I'm not going to go into spoilers about the AP. I'll talk about some overviews and some generalities, but nothing like, and then Luke kills Leia or something like that. Like, we'll keep that free. Why you go Dead Sons is because it's probably the best introduction to Starfinder that you can get. They do have the modules, especially the free one where you choose different pre-gens and you work with that. That's pretty good. They work that in society. That's fine. Dead Sons itself is your first open world. Here's the table. Go ahead. Go. It follows a very outlaw-y, starry type of path where you are looking at stuff from the past as a way to advance your future. But your characters don't necessarily know that at the start.
Okay.
But they learn pretty quick.
So how many players do you have in your campaign so far?
I have four players so far, and I hope to gain none and lose none. The AP is, I think, balanced around four. You could easily add a fifth or sixth and not have much difficulty. If you go lower than that, you're going to want to put in a fourth there as like a pre-gen or a GM character or something, because balancing the encounters is a little odd because of Starfinder's really tight math. Moving bonuses up and down can really be... It's really touch and go, especially if you're used to Pathfinder's math, where throwing around plus one or plus two circumstance bonuses don't completely break things. Currently, I have a mechanic, an android mechanic with the Exocortex, who's done his best to be the range character that he always believes he can be, and the robot in his head tells him he can be. He's working on it. We have a Lashinta Solarian, who went Armor Solarian, while we're trying things that are very difficult. She's a little dissatisfied. The lack of Solarian armor crystals as opposed to weapon crystals makes her feel like she's a little stuck. I might work with that a little bit if she gets a little farther into it. Because right now we're also playing with a soldier who's focused on melee, Alex's human soldier. And while the Solarian, Armor Solarian is a ranged character, It's kind of meant to be like a tank. Like, I'm in the back, but I have a lot of armor, so it's okay if I get hit. And right now, the soldier up front with his armor is doing a better job. And it's like, that doesn't feel great, especially when he's cleaving through people with a sword at an unprecedented rate. And lastly, we have a mystic dedicated to Triune. You've played 40K, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his thing is totally styled off the I'm Messiah. So he's a human that just wants to shed all his parts and get closer to Triune.
Okay. So how far along is that character to being very, very close to Triune?
I think he has like an Apple Watch. Okay. And he refuses to heal people because when your flesh is gone, it'll be fine. We can replace it with cybernetics. He's trying to stay away from healing and more towards actual damage and eventually specking into like the summon monster line and stuff like that. So it's fun that they don't just have this, hey, I'm a heal battery, get out of jail free.
Now, do you think that's going to cause any problems with Starfinder not having a walking heal bot?
No, the stamina system actually works really well to kind of insulate you from that. You know when you're in trouble, and they've been in trouble. They almost, the end of the first book, really did a number on them. But having that stamina system allows you the brevity to let people play what they want to play and have fun with it. And you're not as restrained to, oh, I guess I have to be the cleric this time. You know, nobody gets any of that short end of that stick. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Dead Sun's Adventure Path, what is like the elevator pitch for this thing?
The elevator pitch is joining the Starfinder Society. The Starfinder Society, they give it a bit in the actual like organized play background, but this AP still comes off of that where you, at the beginning, are sent to meet with an agent perspective of joining the Starfinder Society. And then you end up with some Starfinder Society and then bigger world intrigue. The Starfinder Society's deal themselves, kind of like the regular Pathfinder Society, is they are looking to find relics of the past. The difference between them two is Starfinder Society is more focused on a period of time called the Gap, where just nobody knows really what happened. There was a world and then there wasn't, and they're kind of figuring out that. And more specifically, and this isn't so much in the AP, but in the Society line, they're looking to see what happened to an expedition of theirs that went to explore a Gap site. You're in the AP, you're more towards that, hey, go find us, you know, Gap stuff, find out some information relating to, because that information is the most important thing of all. So your pitch is, you're going to come meet up with them, you're going to see if this isn't something that would suit you well for Allegiance. So it's pretty well suited to your intro RPG people that are like, I guess I'm at a bar and I get hired to do a job, I don't want to think too hard behind it, you know, and that's perfectly fine. So it's a good jump in.
Mm-hmm. Now, seeing as it ties into the Starfinder Society, are we going to see a lot of familiar faces, Ziggy, Historia?
As far as I've seen so far, not so much. You could easily throw them in there because they would be in there. You could, if you wanted to, attach part of that society, like infamy reputation system, right in there, and it would fit. It wouldn't be out of place, you know, to give them little boons and stuff like that if you wanted to make it feel a little more inclusive. The AP itself is, it does get some criticisms about being short, and they go, oh, it's a lack of content. It's a lack of specificity in content, more so. Like, if you look at older APs, they tell you who your boss is, what their grandmother did, where they came from, what the town was like, what they ate for breakfast. A lot of stuff that limits your ability to mold them. Mm-hmm. So either you have to ignore all the stuff they gave you, or run with it and have limited creativity for your bad guys or your, you know, notable NPCs. Starfinder and their AP kind of just goes, yeah, this is X, they do Y, you can figure it out from there. So it's not a loss of content, it's a loss of specificity. It is a little shorter than a AP volume usually is, and it is a less of a level progression system than it is in regular Paizo APs, like for Pathfinder. But that doesn't cut down, I think, on enjoyability. I would rather have 12 good hours than 24 hours, you know?
Now, you're right about the shortness. A traditional Pathfinder AP is 96 pages, and a Starfinder one only runs 64 pages, and they both have back matter content. So, how has the back matter been through the APs? Have you found it supplemental to what you're running, or is this more additional Starfinder stuff that needed a place to live?
It's usually your gazetteer, or whatever they call it now, is supplemental to what you're doing. It usually gives races that have been included in races, templates, or locations that are in the AP volume directly. And then there's usually some equipment for them or some relics or items. And those are helpful for building out a player's kit. They are more, I think, necessary for if you're doing society, because that's where a lot of your splash is coming from for equipment right now. But it so far, the splash in the back has been good. Also, the splash in the front has been pretty good. I wrote a whole speech on how they approached Absalom Station at the beginning based on the information that they give you about how Absalom Station is tiered on the outside. It's quality information. It's just not a lot of, God, like I'm running Skulls and Shackles. I'm getting close to the end of it. But there's some points in that where your fluff in the back is a story about a hero going through an island your players will never see, they'll never touch, and has already kind of completed the storyline in that little blurb. And it's like, that was cool for flavor, but that doesn't help me do anything really. So it feels like that stuff's helpful.
Yeah, I do have to admit that sometimes I don't pay all that much close attention to the back matter unless it directly ties into what I need to run in an AP. And I expected there to be more of that with the Starfinder APs, honestly, because of the lack of a player companion line or any other supplemental line. I mean, we're about to approach the first release of another hardcover here soon, which will be the first, it's just going to be the campaign setting book. So while it may have some splat-like material, even that's not your traditional splat book. So besides the core rule book, there hasn't been a lot of room for expanding the player options in the game. And I half expected the back matter of the APs to try to patch that hole.
There are some things in there. I think book two has the Ring of Fangs, I think it's called, but it's an item that scales unarmed damage. If I'm remembering the item correctly. There's also stuff that does more damage types. There's more varieties of sniper rifles in some of the APs. Like, it really builds out the weapons and the items and the magical items and your hybrid items and your tech items, stuff that people want it. If I remember from the Pathfinder show, it looks like Pack Worlds might have some exo suit stuff like exo armors. Mm-hmm. If I remember that answer right. And a couple other things to help boost that a little more, stuff away from weapons, but this at least allows your characters to feel like they're wielding enough variety that you're not just like, I'm the guy with the gun. No, I'm the guy with the gun. No, I'm the guy with the gun. So it's the back matter is helpful. Your players just have to be able to see it. And if you're the one running the AP module, you're going to either have to have them be subscribers anyway and get it, you know, on their own, or you have to kind of be forward and go, hey guys, these are also other options that I'm allowing.
Right. That also becomes an issue because so many of those options have become legal in society, but that means you have to actually own the book, which is encouraging a huge amount of the player base to buy content that we also simultaneously don't want them to read.
Yeah, I have a feeling that maybe that content will be bound up in another compendium book later, or a book that has a compendium, just to help address that. But it seems like this is where it was put for now, because this is where it needs to, the easiest way it was to get these things out for now. Yeah. Go ahead.
There just doesn't seem to be a lot of publishing vectors. I mean, honestly, right now the Starfinder Society is the only thing that seems to have free reign, because publishing PDFs is cost low, as you still have to pay for the art and get the writers, but you don't have to wait for slow boats from China to throw a PDF up on the Paizo site.
Yeah, it makes it a little quicker to respond to the needs of players and everything. But I think that you're going to, you know, see more of those options. I think you could be forthright with giving them. It is a little weird that we're getting it here, but this is also the first, not even the first year that this product's come out. We kind of are able to look back at Pathfinder with like kind of rose-colored glasses of view of all this. It took like till, what is it, the Advanced Class Guide for the Barbarian, I think, or Advanced Player's Guide, sorry, for the Barbarian to get feats that made it so it didn't die when it was raging.
I mean, that I always thought that was a feature for the Barbarian, not so much a drawback.
Just burn up your life because, I don't know, you're angry and then you're unconscious.
Exactly. Raise Dead exists for a reason.
I mean, Reincarnate exists for that same reason.
Mm-hmm. Now, how's the players been receiving the adventure?
You the players have been receiving it pretty well. They came in wanting to play these, mm-hmm. You know, exploring their area. They're very excited about characters. I even let Alex use one of his, you know, third-party written character themes for his little child soldier boy. So they're pretty open to the story. It does kind of make the assumption that you are an explorer type, as opposed to other adventures where it's like, well, now you have to, like you're shoehorned in. Like Reign of Winter shoehorns you in very hard, very quickly to say you have to do this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've never seen quite the god-moded railroad in any adventure path before.
Yeah, and it's also one that doesn't necessarily it doesn't force you to stay in, and it doesn't it doesn't give you incentive to want to stay in if with your character unless your character likes A, adventure, or B, money. Mm-hmm. So if you have a personal backstory of Vendetta, it is actually it's relatively difficult to fit it in to the AAP. There's ways that you can, but it's not as easy as something where, like Kingmaker, where if somebody's backstory comes up, it's you have an easy way to kind of slide it in there. Because Dead Sons is predicated on going to the stars mm-hmm. and seeing a lot of new things and places. And, man, you're not going to find the guy that killed your dad, you know, light years away, most likely.
So it seems to be, actually, you mentioned Reign of Winter, but that seems to be oddly copacetic here because I'm running into the same problem in my Reign of Winter Pathfinder group where a lot of my players brought in, like, personal motivations and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, you're going to be literally light years away from this, and none of that matters anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a quick aside from the Dead Sons Adventure Path that I really like. The Reign of Winter Adventure Path makes it very hard to pick up on those. My GM was very good and creative with getting my backstory stuff in there. I kept for a secret 2 years that I had a brother, and the only reason I was doing this was to look for him. 2 years, nobody knew why I was there. And then at the very last session, they go, oh, and that's your brother. I was so proud. Yeah, and I played an evil character the entire way, and my one wish was like, hey, I want him to be like he was before he was kidnapped, you know. You know, like the day before, I want him to have no memory of this. Like this altruistic wish. It's like, take that, all you nerds that called me evil.
Hmm.
But yeah, so it's like one of those. It's hard to fit it in. You can definitely find a way because it's Starfinder. It's a world of infinite possibilities. Mm-hmm. So you can find a way. It's just going to be shoehorned. It might not be the way that you want it to be.
Now you're picking this up. You guys have just had. How long ago was the first session?
The first session was. I've been running one a month. I believe we started them in December. I think December was our first session.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So how do you think the pace of release is going to affect that? Because up until now, for the first AP, they've been every other month, and they have been shorter than the traditional AP. A lot of people have had expressed concern that they were literally going to run out of content if they ran it like a regular game group.
It depends on your pace. I mean, if you have a weekly gaming group, you are probably going to outstrip an AP, a volume. The first book of Dead Sons took us about 12 hours. It wasn't particularly long. I gave them, they haven't used it yet, but I gave them a slightly refined version of the crafting system to encourage them to do stuff while they're on a spaceship for long periods of time. But you will outstrip it pretty quickly. In fact, there's some places that I know that have been running the first volume of the AP as a day-long module.
Oh,
at like cons, yeah, you could totally get away with it if you really wanted to push it. A lot of the value in it relies on role playing and that keeping open thing. Like for instance, there is a couple groups that you meet, and there's different ways to contact them. The book gives ways on how to do this. It's no big secret. It should be no big secret if your players can roll above a 10 culture check. But you should be open to finding out other ways to do this, like listen to them instead of shoehorn those options, because you can get a lot of mileage out of that. And with how the core rulebook functions out, stuff like services and, you know, your general cost of things, it's pretty easy to benchmark, like to eyeball how much a side adventure costs. Like I had them figure out how much bail was for somebody to work on that as an angle for a NPC group, NPC something. So, you know, that was a good side encounter, and based on your, especially if you have the Alien Archive book, where it gives you your tiers based on CR, you can easily look up those and just give random skill checks. So you go, roughly, if I think this person's 1/2 CR, their perception's roughly this. You know, so it's pretty easy with how the Alien Archive is just to kind of dirtily, really messily do social encounters to help expand those.
Are you going to be, do you find yourself adding a lot of customized content besides the side, is like, is the side adventures become a significant chunk of your adventure time?
Yeah, so what one thing that I really like to do as a GM is I don't like to say no. I always like to say yes, but. So when my players are generally hesitant to jump all on board on an idea, even if it sounds good, because they're like, what's the best option? What do I want to do best? What gives the best return on our time? So what I usually do when they get into this, you know, headspace of, oh, we're paralyzed with choice, is I go, I'm going to go to the bathroom. You guys take 2 minutes. You guys figure out what you want to do, and I'll come back. And I'll come back and I'll listen to that idea, even if it's stupid. Even if I think on the surface it's stupid, I'll listen to it. And I will try to see how that would work, and I'd run them through the consequences. So I like to play a really open-style RPG. I like them to make mistakes, because mistakes are way funnier than successes. So lead them into those traps. But I find myself ad-libbing a lot of encounters. I don't really go out of my way to create like side encounters or side stories. They just kind of happen based on how they want to go about things. And once again, the cost of services, the Alien Archive stat arrays, it makes it really quick for me to just to go, ah, this is roughly this. And there's plenty of room to throw stuff in. I would caution against throwing in more encounters. The first book is jam-packed full of encounters, and some of them are particularly difficult, especially towards the end of the first book. But you won't need to be throwing out encounters. What you will need to do is, look at the FAQ, which we'll talk about a little later, and know how the tactics of the enemies work, because that makes a big difference on their effectiveness. And that will be a combat. Look to give them more social things. Look for them to step out of their shell. Make them uncomfortable, because this is a cyberpunk world. Well, not cyberpunk. Sci-fi. Sci-fantasy. Cyberpunk. Basically.
Now, half of the Starfinder is the star part, so how, without going into spoilers if you can, tell us about how the amount of ship combat the adventure path seems to be affording you.
You will see ship combat within the first book, and you will see some at the beginning of the second book, which could be part of the first book, depending on how you prep it. It gives a safe place for your newbie space people to figure out what they're doing. There is the kind of weirdness in that the looks like the expected party is 4 people, but there's more roles on a ship, so they do a little bit of switching.
I have run into this, and I do not know how to solve the problem.
So there's a couple ways that you can go about it. There's secondary actions, which allow, like, when you're piloting a single-person fighter, you can move, and then you can shoot one gun at a -2. You can have players take those secondary actions if they want to do gunnery at a -, or if your pilot wants to shoot a gun at a -2. They're not in the same area, which can be a little issue, but if you just want to hand-wave that part. Generally, your spaceship combats aren't so difficult as that is a killer. It would be... I think later on I'd have to see how they perform. It might behoove to do like an auto target or like kind of stationary crew member who kind of can be wheeled to an area who's not really a person. It's, you know, like a iPad on a Segway that just operates one of their sections. You know, you'll find plenty of NPCs throughout the AP. So having one of them aboard to kind of take over that supplementary role shouldn't be too hard. But it is a little wonky where you're like, hey, we have 3 gun arcs and we need somebody to pilot the ship. So it's like, nobody can go on science officer. Nobody can go on engineer at that point. So also part of that is their planning, making sure that they know what arcs they're in, arcs they're going to be, that they know where their captain's going to go. Because if they all go, we only have room for 2 gunners. We're going to go front and we're going to go port side. And then your pilot takes you around starboard side. It's like, great. Now we don't have anybody to shoot a gun there, you know, making sure that you're all together. So it's a cooperative teamwork thing. They should do better once they start learning teamwork. But you'll get ship combat.
Now, speaking of teamwork, how's the team itself cohesive? Are they developing strategies?
The strategy right now is push the boy soldier out front whose age gets lower every time they mention it, and he'll either kill it with his sword or he'll be knocked unconscious, and then the faithful of Trium can pick up the pieces.
So if this is going to continue with the kid getting younger every time he comes up, when does he have to make the stats for the pregnant mother?
We haven't gotten that far back. We have kind of just, I think he started out as 17, and every time they mention it, he gets a little bit younger. yeah, so it's like, you know, 17-year-old, why do you have a 16-year-old with you, you know? So, but he's kind of been their melee beat stick because, man, melee damage really ramps up really quick. It seems to level out as you go a little farther, but at the beginning, being able to just put static strength behind a damage along with eventually getting specialization behind it is really, really powerful at those lower levels.
Is he also going down as frequently as we theorized that the front combatant would go down?
Yes and no. I also had a little bit of a boo-boo with a rule that I will discuss in a minute, but he's gone down as much as I expected him to, which is roughly every other fight.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just the nature of the beast. I've also knocked a lot of them unconscious. Oftentimes it's a ring around the rosy of, oh, I spend a point of resolve to stabilize. I spend a point of resolve next turn to stand up. Like, it's a lot of ring around the rosy of spending resolve points because they're at the point where they didn't have enough healing to get through an area, and it's just they didn't have the time. Some of the encounters, especially on the back end, are really rough if you really look at how the rules want you to do them.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of how the rules want you to do it, you just mentioned that you messed up some rules.
Yeah. So just like at the beginning of every AP, there's a encounter that has a disease mechanic. Mm-hmm. You know, your Skulls and Shackles has it with rats. It's so common, it's not really even a spoiler. Diseases in Starfinder work differently. They use the track rules. I kind of went shorthand and lazy and just kind of completed my knowledge with Pathfinder, and that makes the system break. It does not work when you do it like that. You go down your track, and the first failure for a disease on the on one of the tracks is like weakened, so you get like -2 to everything, and then it gets worse from there based on your track progression. Doesn't matter what it says on the disease, like secondary effects, like that is secondary. I kind of forgot that and went like base Pathfinder where I go, oh, that's what happens if this hits gestation or hits, you know, manifestation. So I also inconveniently forgot that the DCs don't change. In Pathfinder, when you're repeatedly inoculated, the DC goes up. It's harder to shake off, you know, typhoid when people are coughing on you, a lot of them. So this character kept getting that. Eventually their DC was like a 22, which is not succeedable. With any regularity at that level of Starfinder, not even a little bit. So we kind of waved it off because I made them spend time to clear this, but it's something that really would have done much worse to their entire party than what I put it as. I just kind of bullied Alex by accident. Stop the bullying, 2018. I accidentally bullied him. I filled the young child with worms. Accident. If you just want to cut down all my NPCs, like it's medieval combat in space, I wouldn't have to, you know, make him feel all gross.
This is just deep GM-induced Darwinism.
Yeah, right? So, you know, read through those rules. Make sure you know how those things progress. They are a little weird because it talks about, in the core rulebook, it talks about multiple getting afflictions. What is that? Contracting of afflictions. In the poison sections, but not the disease section. And it's supposed to work like how it does in the poison section. Because Alex not liking being sick is all get out. Talked about it. And there were some devs that ended up kind of commenting on it, like, oh, this is kind of how it should work. So you might get a clarification that multiple diseases are like multiple poisons. You might not. Just, you know, work with it. Realize what you're doing. I feel bad.
It's all right. I'm sure that he was magnanimous and understanding and forgiving.
I mean, he has to be.
Oh, yeah. There was a scheduling conflict, for those of you curious as to where Alex is. He's not able to join us due to a scheduling conflict, and he will be rejoining us. We have not kicked him out of the podcast or anything drastic like that.
I mean, I may have sold him to the highest bidder.
Starfinder does allow slavery.
Yeah. It's not a good practice, but I just bought a house, so I need money.
How is the house hunting?
Oh, over. I bought a house.
Oh, well, fantastic. The view. Yeah. You found a room in your house just like the one you usually broadcast from?
Oh, no. We're moving a little bit later because I need some repairs. But I will have a whole Starfinder / RPG room with big gaming table and everything. So I'm very excited about that, where I can run this. And I'll actually have room to keep all of my Dead Sons paraphernalia.
Are you going to go with like the digital tabletop? And like, you're going to get to design from scratch, man.
My friend has a digital tabletop. I'm not a fan of them. I don't know if you know this. Gamers are awful at, like, respecting property after a while. Somebody just touches that, it breaks. I don't need all that. I've been using, like, 3D Terrain. Like, I did a blog about it, but, like, for instance, magnetize, like, walls and stuff like that. So I prefer them to have 3D Terrain that they can move around in.
The Hearst Arts. That's the plaster stuff, right?
That's the stuff out of Dental Plaster. And I actually didn't make enough for the entirety of one of the dungeons, so I had to rebuild it and rebuild it as they're going, you know, and just, like, mark off where they've been. But it helps them realize what tight spaces you're in. So it's been fun.
I've played Mass Effect 3. You just build that into the encounter. The dungeon is literally rebuilding underneath your feet.
They've started making WizKids and Reaper. They've started making a lot of plastic terrain. Mm-hmm. Like, I bought a dumpster. I didn't think I'd ever buy a dumpster, but I have a dumpster that I'm going to place whenever we do nightclubs again. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much good, and also with war games like Infinity, there's a lot of good, fun, appropriate terrain out there. Also, I see if I can find one around here. I think I packed them all up for priming. There's a person who works off Facebook. It's like Low Poly 3D Designs that will make very low poly scenery, stuff like tables, chairs, your base stuff that you don't want to pay a lot for. Mm-hmm. And he makes them pretty cheap, and I've gotten quite a few things off there, and I've been pretty happy with how they've come out. So, like, as far as 3D maps, you're going to lose out on them a little bit because people get tired. People go, is that a door? Is that a wall? If your people aren't paying attention. If you have stuff there, they're going to realize, oh, I can't go down here. Oh, this is claustrophobic. It's a more fun experience.
Now all you need to do is strap tiny little GoPros to the miniature's forehead so they can get first-person views.
It would just be knocking them over because they go unconscious.
Oh, well, that's fine.
But yeah, so the AP does have a fair amount of indoor segments, but you do eventually get to explore other places. So, like, when we were doing the mechanic review, we were kind of like, hey, everything's contingent on you being around computers. I will tell you, there's parts in the AP where you're not exactly going to be close to a computer. Or you might be close to something and you're not sure it's a computer. So if you're a GM, be nice. People wear computers on their wrists. You have cell phones, you know. Throw your mechanic a bone. Help them.
You mentioned Outlaw Star as a similarity. Any other sci-fi similarities you've noticed?
Outlaw Star is the biggest one. Also, I've just been rewatching that because I really, really, really enjoy the pulpiness of that.
I like spaceships that can punch.
Yeah. Why are they stronger? Because they have grapple arms. I don't know. Apparently that makes them stronger. But it's hard to find a... As weird as it sounds... I like the world of Ruby, even though it's not a nearly direct comparison, but how they link magic and technology into a not exactly super high-tech setting, where you have guns that are also nunchucks, and you have people that manifest, elemental magic with, you know, basically magic powder in areas that are like rural villages, but also there's a big military that exists on another continent. Like, you seem to get all of this. You do get a lot of your hard Blade Runner... or Mass Effect. In fact, I just stopped calling it Absalom Station. I started calling it the Citadel. I just call it the Citadel because Absalom Station is too much. So you have a fair amount of that. But with the application and use of magic, which is something that does not exist as much in the Mass Effect world, you know, they do their little psychokinesis, you know, occulty stuff, but not actual magic. Things like... a regular magic high school or Outlaw Star that really, really pushed magic as a thing that you would do in the 23rd millennium. They really spring up the front forefront. And not so much Warhammer 40K. I see a lot of people going, 40K. 40K is grimdark. 40K is the tabletop version of Rocks Fall, Everyone Dies. It's heresy and then you're exterminatus. Like, there's not a game there.
No.
It's just living like a rat.
And magic is, like, stupidly risky in 40K. It's like, I may succeed in accomplishing this thing, or I may open up a gate to hell and forever warp my body.
No, so the actual, because I started playing 40K again, the actual rules of failing magic are, an evil demon comes through my body and I hurt people around me because I explode from fragments of this demon manifesting because I was the pinprick of light in their area. It's like, dude, that magic is horrible.
No, why would you ever practice it?
Burn the witch. I'm fully with them. Burn the witch. But probably closer to Mass Effect with magic, Outlaw Star. It's you can go cutesy and poppy with it. You can go you know, Flash Gordon, you know, what would you call that? Jet Set, you know, that kind of weird...
Oh, the retrofuturism stuff.
There we go. All I'm thinking of is yellow and green panels. That's all I could think, and I forget the word for that. But, you know, that whole retrofuturism, you can go that way with it, you can go Star Trek with it, or you can go more modern sci-fi, and it all seems to fit. If you went Star Trek with it, it would be pretty fun, because, you know, not messing with other species.
I cannot imagine a player group that would ever, in any circumstance, maintain the Prime Directive.
No. Anybody in RPG never maintains the Prime Directive. They go, we want to maintain the Prime Directive. Oh, they have stuff in their bag? I take their bag. RPG players are the worst.
Oh, well, it's a long-standing tradition.
It is, but they're so not the heroes, and they never have been. They're just accidentally the heroes because you pay them.
All right. Well, speaking of accidentally the heroes, we will be right back in a moment as we go over some of the news, including the FAQ for Starfinder.
Ooh.
And we're back.
Oh, we are.
So, besides prepping for Adventure Paths, there has been a little bit of news for Starfinder that's come out, some of which has broken on this show during previous episodes, or more specifically during the Eric Mona interview in No Direction. So, but this is our first chance to really get our teeth into some of this news items. So let's start off with what we talked about. A new FAQ has been released for Starfinder, and this time we are actually having some real class balance issues and class, well, more corrections. They don't seem to be actual, this isn't anything like the shifter rules we saw for Pathfinder last week, where the class was basically being rewritten from the ground up. This is more, well, that's obviously how that was supposed to go, so let's fix it.
Yeah, it's a definite upgrade. It clarifies probably one of the biggest things people had issues with was the operative being too good.
Yeah, the operative being too good. Well, specifically, ghost operatives being broken. For those of you who don't know, the operative usually has some specializations that determine how it does its trick attack and some of the skill bonuses it gets as it goes about being its ninja spy self. Now, when those skills happen to not tie into its primary attribute, they get a little bonus when they're used in order to keep them on competitive edge with the ones that use the stat you're going to pump to infinity. But
and beyond.
Yeah. But one of those specializations, the ghost specialization, happened to have that +4 bonus that was given to the other specializations, but it uses dexterity. So you were able to basically become God among men, never fail this role when you were ghost specialization, because if you were an operative, you're going to have a 16 minimum, up to 18, maybe not probably, but eventually, yes, 18 dexterity, because there's very little reason you wouldn't. It's your primary attribute. It's your guns. It's most of your skills. It's the super stat.
Melee weapons.
It's your super stat. And it also ties into the skill you're going to use for your main class ability, which is to do the trick attacks. And with that +4 bonus, it just seemed out there. Also, because it was the only dex one that had the +4 bonus, and there was an explanation given on the forums that the +4 bonus really was to make up for the skills that didn't have dex bonus, this correction we saw coming from a mile away. So, ghost specialization operative. Let me get the exact wording here. It says, is it supposed to get the +4 dexterity space skill bonus to perform the trick attack? Nope! The ghost specialization only gives a +1 bonus to stealth checks made to perform the trick attack, bringing it back in line with all the other specializations.
Ding dong, the witch is dead.
This wasn't the worst part of the operative, but it was definitely... Well, there were a lot of ghosts out there.
It limited variety. You didn't see many other types of operatives.
And I find it surprising. I wonder how many rebuilds we're going to see in society because of this. I mean, the operative is still a top-tier class. It now that it's behaving like it's supposed to. And like we said, how did you not see this coming? It was so obviously an error, not intended.
Yeah, if you were min-maxing based off of it, if you ever play that type of style, you have to realize that it's eventually going to change. Mm-hmm. It's okay. It was fun while it lasted.
Some other FAQ items related to the operative is that the debilitating snapper trick is supposed to actually function like intended.
yeah, it works now. You can actually use it with a sniper weapon. Yep. Before the action economy wasn't there.
Yep. So basically it says that if you have the debilitating snapper, any other special ability that specifically allows you to use trick attack with a sniper weapon, using trick attack with a sniper weapon counts as taking a move action to aim the weapon and use the range increment listed on the sniper weapon special ability. You can do this even with unwieldy sniper weapons. Now, this was a necessary correction in the language, but if you just go by the normal rules of more specific always trumps less specific, this should have been more obvious, but yeah. This at least clears it up. There's a lot of clearing up language in this FAQ, such as, can you make a trick attack using stealth even in a situation where you can't use stealth, such as somebody has direct line of sight to you in a brightly lit room and put dust on you and has a cat's laser pointer right in your eye, then yeah, you can still use the stealth skill to try the trick attack. Just because you can't actually go into a stealth condition doesn't mean that you can't use your class ability as it's supposed to be used.
Yeah, you can keep your neon glowing hula hoop and do them.
Yep. Some of the other... The mechanic also was the recipient to a little bit more corrections. I say some of the ones that are more important is that the Mechanics Drones does not have to pay twice as much to get its weapons despite its different size, because it says that there's an exception to the rule that its special mount is meant to hold medium-sized weapons, not tiny weapons.
Not kid-sized versions of your laser pistols.
Nope. You did not get these out of a gacha machine. You actually strapped your real pistol. And we're saying weapon mount with some air quotes, because let's be honest, this is duct tape, right?
Yeah, no, it's definitely the Warhammer 40K orc way of doing it. Mm-hmm. You paint it red, you tape it on.
Also, when it says that it counts as a Mark 1 comm unit, they specifically say that does mean a personal comm unit. That's probably some evidence of an editing mistake where one thing was once called something else. Also, the hover drone doesn't actually hover. For those of you who have been using the hover drone as a hover drone, you've been doing it wrong. It does not have perfect mobility by default. But if you take the flight upgrade, it will then get perfect maneuverability and can then hover again.
Yeah, it's misleading. It's more like an airplane drone now.
Mm-hmm. Well, as somebody who has piloted a drone, it usually does take a little bit of finesse before you're able to actually hover that darn thing. And the more expensive upgraded models that have the GPS stabilization unit make that much easier. So this is at least true to life.
Yeah, in this game, true to life. Yeah.
All right.
We also have one about the Solarian's Stellar Rush revelation. Mm-hmm. That as long as you try to bull rush, you get fire damage. Yep. Even if the bull rush fails, you just have to try to bull rush them.
This is a buff to that ability because of how ridiculously hard it can be in Starfinder to attempt combat maneuvers.
And succeed at them. Attempting them is easy. You just say, I want to do this. Right. Succeeding them is very difficult, especially if they are bigger than you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Beyond that, this is actually a bit of an older upgrade, but you called it out during the pre-show. But there is a clarification that was published actually back in the November update that we didn't draw attention to, but needs to be drawn a lot more attention to, is mm-hmm. that under actions on page 322, it states that class features and items affect crew actions only if specifically noted in the class feature action. This means for starship combat. And what this meant as written is that even if you had bonuses and class abilities that gave you advantages when using the very skills you wanted to use in starship combat, suddenly all those abilities turned off for no reason.
Your envoy was suddenly not charismatic anymore and couldn't give speech as well.
No. And of course, every class had some sort of boost to some skill somewhere, and those all turned off. Well, no, the answer is no. This is actually going to be a change to the way the game works. When the action is taken in Starship Combat, calls for a skill check, any class feature that grants a bonus or allows a reroll with the relevant skill applies when using that skill as part of Starship Combat. This is now an exception to the rule. Posted November 28th, 2017. So we will likely see that in an errata when they do a reprint of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I've been kind of just going through with it, and nobody's ever called me on it because I thought that was the weirdest thing. And yeah, and there was a clarification to back it up eventually. So it's like, good. I'm glad I wasn't too far off. But it was weird. It's like, hey, you don't get to be good at talking, Miss Intergalactic Pop Idol. It's like, well, I'll take my ball and go home then. It was very weird.
And then there was an errata for the Alien Archive.
Yeah, there was one clarification, and they're both clarifications. One is, if you're using a PC from the Alien Archive, like a player race, you don't get the graft on top. The grafts are for NPCs only. You don't get, if you pick up a Barathu, you don't get then get the Barathu graph on top of it. Also, the other one was, hey, these races don't have hands. How do they do things? They do things. They find hands. They put it in their little straps. Mm-hmm. They're not going to gimp races because they don't have hands you can see. I mean, even starfish have little tendrils that come out when they need them. You don't know. Mm-hmm. We've never seen an Urgog try to play chess.
I mean, watch any sci-fi show ever. The little tentacle just wraps around the trigger, or they get little adapters, or the equipment is catered to their specific shape. I mean, this is a future where we can fabricate anything in a limited amount of time using super plastic. I'm pretty sure that they can manage to account for three fingers as opposed to a tentacle.
Yeah, right? It's just a glove. That's just a prosthetic glove. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's just in there as a clarification.
And the other bit of news, well, this was announced shortly before we had an interview with Eric Mona, so we talked about it a little bit there, but there's going to be a change in the publishing schedule going forward for the Starfinder Adventure Paths. Part 1, it is going to monthly. Yay! Woo! More content, woo! More adventures. And more it is changing into weirdness because there's going to be a 6-part Adventure Path released and then 2 3-part Adventure Paths. And mm-hmm. one of those Adventure Paths will not begin at first level.
That wasn't the exact quote, but it was, we cannot guarantee that they will all start at first level. So there's healthy room there for you to get a second adventure in maybe with one of your characters, because Dead Sons only hits a cap of around, I think, either 11 or 12, or maybe even 10. The cap isn't very high on Dead Sons, so you could take these characters on other adventures.
I think we did press Eric Mona during the interview to clarify that one will not be first level.
Okay, I forgot that part.
All right, so okay, I think this is smart, and I do think that, okay, we needed monthly adventure paths. Also, yes. Starfinder does not have the wealth of backlog of the whole other module line supporting it that Pathfinder had. So these 3-part adventures will provide shorter format adventures that Starfinder would never have gotten access to, barring an expansion of releases in some form. And I think it's a great way to handle the game going forward. I don't see any downsides to it, actually.
No, being able to take your characters on other adventures is one of the, I think, most fun things about it, like Pathfinder Society, is where you say, oh, my character got to do X, Y, and Z instead of my character spent 17 levels trying to fight a dragon. You know, it allows you to have a little more lineage, a little more history. I think it's pretty fun. I was going to go somewhere else with that, tag off of that. But the fact that they're split up too, because I think the 3-parters won't be directly after each other, like from what I was hearing. Does that seem correct? Like it was a 3-part, then a 6-part, then a 3-part, right?
I have not heard of the exact release schedule yet.
Yeah, I can't confirm anything.
I had been lobbying for a crazy release schedule of staggering them.
And I mean, even if the 3-parters are only 3 books, based on the first book of Dead Sons taking roughly 12 hours, you know, that's at least 36 hours of content based on that, which is, I think, for a 3-month span, pretty pretty crunchy enough for a average gaming group. If you are Order of the Amber Die and blitzing it out, yeah, you're going to run through it. But if you're, a group of people that get to meet once or twice a month, that should subsist you.
Well, some of the last few modules, when they switched to those Uber modules that were twice as thick, and those were pure adventure, I say that would probably be the equivalent of 3 volumes of AP once you account for the back banner.
Yeah. And we may or may not see as much stuff in the back going forward with APs. We may see them eventually story out as they fill in equipment gaps that people are used to coming from other RPGs like Pathfinder or D&D 5e, because there's just a lot of stuff missing in Starfinder as of right now. So they're just patching stuff in. So you may see that equipment section get a little smaller. You may see that be replaced with a couple more pages of adventure. You're going to have plenty to play with.
Yeah. Plus, the release of the new adventure pass would be after the armory is released. So I think that's how that's going to line up. The armory should be either coming out or already out by the time these launch. So that should also put a big giant patch in the problem with the very limited equipment section.
Yeah, I mean, once we get that book, I mean, everybody should be fine with pretty much everything they want to find. I mean, if you're doing a home game right now, there's enough base stuff there to cost out what you would like to try to do. You have enough examples of what weapon enhancements are to port over enhancements to see roughly where they fall. You know, you have enough to figure out what limbs are, maybe more vehicle stuff, but those rules haven't seemed to be as popular because they're the middle child between Starship and regular combat, but you might see more stuff for them. The only thing that might be hard to figure out is the armor balance, because that is based on a math formula that Alex has confided with me makes his head hurt. So doing that on your own might be a little iffy. So once we get more backlog in on that, we should be good.
Excellent. And the next news item would normally be a shout-out, but this show doesn't have a shout-out section. I guess it could have one, but we haven't done that yet. But I did want to get a little bit of debatey about this, or at least ooh coolly about this. This is... hang on with me, okay? So... mm-hmm. Star Trek Online, which is a free-to-play online Star Trek game in which part of the game is you customize your own starship, has recently announced that they are going to be partnering with a 3D printing service to let you print those starships in a variety of sizes. This means that potentially, in a very short time, we will be able to finally have a place where we can customize a starship and print out a miniature for our Starfinder games. And since it's a free-to-play game, well, the entry cost should be a lot lower.
Yeah, I haven't played the game, so I don't know what options are available. Maybe higher tier ships like look cooler and have more pieces, so that might be a potential hurdle. But there is a lot of options there. I mean, you can still find models from Battlefleet Gothic, the 40K game. Mm-hmm. And on websites like Shapeways, you can always find places making what are those? They're parodies or faithful nods to them, you know, just regarding the licensing issue. Mm-hmm. You should be able to find ships. It's kind of finding the ships that you see in your books because they haven't come out yet, like specifically, mm-hmm. and just your time for looking. Scale is an issue too. I think Halo has the best looking sci-fi ships, and they made a starship combat game for the Halo universe, but a lot of the ships are 3-4 inches long, so they kind of take that out. But the Star Trek one hopefully provides it in if you're into that style of starship. Yeah.
Well, the reason I think it's more this is better than some of the other options is this should allow for actual customization of the ship to change out the parts and build what you want it to be, as opposed to just going and finding a copy of a famous sci-fi ship or some generic game tokens. Because right now, basically what we ultimately want is we want Hero Forge for starships so that we can make sci-fi vehicles and stuff like that. And I have little doubt that Hero Forge and companies like that are aware of the sudden need for something like that in the space that Starfinder has created. So I hope that it's not too long before we see that. This was just announced today, so I was like, well, that might be a roundabout hack on how to achieve the same thing. I have played the game briefly, mm-hmm. I hear it has much improved as a game. I do not currently play the game.
I mean, I don't either. Did you get any idea about pricing yet, or were they kind of iffy on that?
They haven't mentioned anything in pricing, but then I went to check out Mixed Dimensions, which is the company they are partnering with, and their stuff is a little on the high side. Like a little, very much on the high side of printing cost.
Like in the hundreds, or?
Well, the stuff they were offering were like statue-sized pieces, like 12-inch tall stuff, and that was like $400 or $500, which is not the scale we would be wanting these in.
No.
They do have an example of one of the prints that they said they printed out as a 12-inch model. Now, they did make very clear in the announcement that these would be available as different options and sizes. So they just their most impressive one is the one they led with, which is hand-painted, high-resolution, really cool-looking Starship. But moving forward, I don't think that's what we would be looking for as a game mechanic. Now, this is not the first time a game company has done this. Famously, World of Warcraft had a 3D printing option for their character models.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I ordered one of those for my gnome mage, and those cost $150 each back then. But of course, that was years before 3D printers were purchasable in homes. I think the ultimate solution will be some sort of service that eventually gets created where we can have SDL files and can just print these at home on their home printers.
I mean, so depending on the spaceship style, if you were able to just write up something in CAD, like spaceships are relatively bulky, and you can find 3D models of ships relatively easily, and you can probably get them printed out. Can't believe you spent $150 on a lawn gnome.
It's not even a lawn gnome. It's a paper gnome because they use the paper model for 3D printing, and it's in a little dome of glass.
I mean, does it at least look good?
It looks faded out. It's the old character model, so it's super polygonal, and it would not be a very successful product in this day and age. Still,
brighter days ahead.
Yep. I was young and I was stupid, and I've not grown any more intelligent since then either. I mean, not even an inch.
We should be able to get a service like that, or at least more options.
I mean, I just spent a whole bunch of money customizing a fight stick, so no, I have not gotten any more fiscally responsible.
But yeah, so more Starship options, always a good thing. Yeah. I had trouble focusing, and I was showing Param here. I'll probably put it up as a picture, maybe in the Discord. I'm almost done working on the Sunrise Maiden. Once again, they don't have an official figure, or they do, but it's not out yet, I think is what it is.
They do. It's not out yet, and the other option is it is available as a pawn.
Ah, so I got like a ship from a collector set of marked down Firefly ships. So that's almost done. That'll be fun. So there's other options definitely to go around. I'll probably post a picture of that up in the Discord because I could not get it to focus.
All right. Anything else you want to shout out to, James?
No, there's not any conventions coming up or anything. I don't have any shout outs.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining us for episode 12 of No Direction Beyond. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We don't have a topic to announce yet, but we will be back, and hopefully we will have Alex back with us and have the full crew on hand again. So
I miss Alex.
Yeah, I miss Alex already, too. All right, guys. So until next time, go beyond with no direction.